I'm Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something, in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region, a new show from KRCC. Today, we speak with University of Kansas Professor of Religious Studies, Timothy Miller, on the history and legacy of the Southern Colorado hippie art commune, Drop City.
I've always thought Mad Magazine had something to do with it, just poking fun at the normal established way of life.
We speak with Sylvia Nasser, award-winning author of the books A Beautiful Mind and Grand Pursuit, The Story of Economic Genius.
The rhetoric may be the welfare state is going to be dead or it's going to take over everything, but we're always talking about changes at the margin. The consequences couldn't possibly be as catastrophic as people in the debate say.
And we speak with Senga Nengudi, a Colorado Springs-based artist whose work has been displayed in some of the most prestigious art institutions in the world.
I want you to respond. I don't want you to just be an observer looking at a piece of art. I want you to be with me.
All that today on The Big Something. Fifty years ago this year, two young artists from Lawrence, Kansas, Jean and Joanne Bernofsky, joined forces with their friend Clark Rickert, a student at the University of Colorado Boulder, and moved to Trinidad, Colorado to start one of the most influential communes of the hippie era, Drop City. In honor of the 50th anniversary of Drop City, arts and archaeology organizations across southern Colorado have planned exhibits and events exploring the history of the commune. Timothy Miller, professor of religious studies at the University of Kansas and author of The 60s Communes, Hippies and Beyond, will be speaking at Pueblo Rawlings Library in May as part of the festivities. KRCC's Noel Black spoke with Miller about the story and the legacy of Drop City.
To start off, if you could give a quick primer on the predecessors of the 60s commune movement that led up to Drop City. What were the things that were kind of in the air?
Communes have been around forever, practically, thousands of years for sure. So in that sense, there's nothing new going on here. What I think happened, though, is there was just a great cultural shift starting in the early 1960s and going on through probably around the middle of the 1970s, roughly. There was just a time when all kinds of things changed in society, challenging existing ways of life. I've always thought Mad Magazine had something to do with it, just poking fun at the normal established way of life in America. There were a lot of other things as well. We had Playboy magazine coming out and showing bare women's breasts, putting them out before the public for the first time. It was just a time when the whole culture was changing. And communes are just part of that, as I see it. Of course, you have the beginnings of a drug culture. Marijuana had been around for a long time, but mainly in isolated subcultures, jazz musicians and things like that. But suddenly, in fairly short order, it becomes available to a much larger public. LSD invented in the 1930s, but nothing was done with it until the 1950s and into the 60s. And that certainly had a big impact on things. Ken Kesey volunteered for LSD experiments and went on to write these powerful novels that I think had a big impact on the culture. And not incidentally, he also contributed to early communal living. There were people in his neighborhood in Palo Alto who began to hang out together and move toward communal living. He left that area after a while. He had the money from his very successful book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and bought a place in a fairly isolated location, and it developed into a full-blown countercultural scene, all of this by about the mid-60s. So there was a lot of ferment in the culture. Things were just changing. A lot of innovation, a lot of questioning. Suddenly, the ability to challenge the government, to challenge the people in power, was there. You could do it and have a chance of being heard. And that just hadn't been the case before.
In your book, Drop City marks what you call a new communal era. What was it about Drop City in particular that made you see that as that dividing point between the earlier movement in the United States that didn't spread as widely?
Drop City, to my mind, really represents a turning point in that it brought all of these elements together. We had countercultural things going on by then. I think Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters are a pretty good example of it. They are really challenging the culture frontally. They're taking LSD freely and declaring that life can be fun and that's okay. You don't have to be so serious about everything. So you've got that. You've got art, you know, changes in the art world. You've had open land communities. A woman named Amelia Newell, as early as 1962, had opened her land to anyone who wanted to live there. And Drop City is what brought all of these changes together. It was the arts, it was open land, it was a real flamboyant denial of the values of the culture. We're only going to fit in where we want to fit in, not everywhere. Drop City rejected jobs. As one of the leaders of Drop City said, it's a sucking of the soul. We don't want to be that way. We're going to develop a whole new civilization, and we're going to do it without jobs. So we're going to live on the leftovers of society, live on the scraps. And to my mind, they just took all of these things and brought them together in a way that kind of blew the trumpet, said, well, a new culture is here, and this is it.
The architecture of Drop City was obviously a huge part of it. The founders attended a lecture by Buckminster Fuller and ended up deciding to base the architecture around his ideas, the Buckyballs, and it ended up being an incredibly visually striking place. Do you think that was a big part of why there was so much attention given to Drop City?
Well, sure. Oh, yeah, the visuals, I think, had an awful lot to do with it. Strikingly unusual architecture, for sure. It was all related, as much as anything, to their desire to live on nothing, to not have to spend money to survive. When they had started out, they didn't have the domes at first. They have, if you look at some of the pictures of Drop City, there are a number of other structures there. They're quite eccentric. They're not anything conventional at all. They're built from scrap of various kinds, usually. But it was only after Clark Rickard had gone to a lecture by Buckminster Fuller, I think, and came back bubbling with enthusiasm about geodesic domes that they decided to do that. And it also fit with their ethic of not spending money because they could get scraps of lumber for free or for virtually free. The local lumber mill threw away, I can't remember what they told me, I think things that were under 2 feet or 4 feet long, something. These odd pieces just went into a big scrap pile, and so they could take it and put it together. Well, that worked great for domes, because domes have all these little interconnected pieces. And so they didn't have any professional knowledge of this at all. They just looked at it and said, okay, this is what we're going to do, and they began building and came up with some really creative stuff. Then they needed to cover it, and what do you do? Well, they hit upon this idea of car tops and went all up and down the Front Range looking for junkyards and cutting car tops right out of cars. So all the ethic of cheap combined with Buckminster Fuller's rather visionary ideas, his geodesic domes, and they made some quite amazing structures, I think. Some of them as big as, I think, about 40 feet in diameter. That's quite a big structure to be building out of scrap.
Yeah.
But they did it.
As far as the history of communes in the United States, was Drop City really the first to be based around an art movement?
No, it was not. There had been artistic communes. Actually, they go back a long ways in American history. I think the last really major outburst of them before Drop City came around the turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th century. In the arts, there was the arts and crafts movement at that time. And that movement spawned a number of intentional communities. There was one in the suburbs of Philadelphia called Rose Valley, where they occupied an old abandoned mill building and used the big space that they had to create all kinds of arts, built furniture, various kinds of visual arts. So that was a communal enterprise. There was one in New York State at Woodstock, New York, called Birdcliff, right at the beginning of the 20th century. And again, people, very, very creative people, some of the leading artists of the time, I would say, came together and began to have various kinds of artistic activity. But the arts and crafts movement had quite an influence for several decades in the United States. And there were many communes connected to it, the artists getting together and working in a place where they could share their talents. And that was a practical thing to do, help people do something they couldn't do by themselves so easily.
As a historian, do you make a distinction between early art communes and art colonies, places like Taos or even Colorado Springs, where the Broadmoor Academy was happening?
The difference to me is simply the amount of economic involvement. An artist colony, as I see it, could be just a place where artists tend to gather, Taos being a good example. But they're not really sharing economically. They're not really living together. So, you know, there's a range from just like-minded people living nearby and sharing ideas to a very complete involvement, living under one roof and sharing resources, being really, truly communal.
As far as art went, I think it's Drop City is thought of more as a commune, but it did end up being ahead of its time in a number of ways. Talk about what the ultimate painting was and the being bag, which were things that went on to be influential but didn't really make it out of Drop City in its time.
Well, I've seen pictures of the ultimate painting. It's a meticulous piece of work. It's very carefully done. They must have worked on it for a long time. Very precise, intricate work, small pieces all neatly painted together. And, of course, the idea of it was to be spun under a strobe light. It was a round painting, and it was to be spun on a pivot. I don't know too much about it. I never saw it. They let someone borrow it to take it, I think, to the East Coast or something, and it was never seen again.
To back up a little bit, can you talk about the formation of Drop City and the original three, what it was they were doing artistically and how that led to the name and the community?
Gene Bernofsky and Joanne Bernofsky and Clark Rickert were all students at the University of Kansas, and they lived in an apartment on the second floor downtown on the main drag on Massachusetts Street. They lived in this kind of loft-like apartment upstairs, and that's where they began creating art together. I mean, they were friends from art school, but they began creating art together and dropped it onto the sidewalk below. One of the several things they did was they painted rocks. And then they just dropped them onto the sidewalk and then sat up in their window and watched to see how people would respond to that. And they did a bunch of kind of, today we might call them, I don't know, situation, I suppose, but things like cooking a complete breakfast, bacon and eggs and what have you, and then put a nice place setting together and setting it all out on the sidewalk and then watching people walk by and wonder, what in the world is this? So they were doing that kind of thing. They did a bunch of different things, just offbeat stuff. And again, today, art is all over the place, I think. But in those days, there was kind of a, what would you say, there were canons of art. There were things that were accepted as art and things that weren't. And I think they were pushing at the boundaries in some important ways. But that's where the name Drop City came from. It was drop art. They began calling it drop art. And then they got the idea that they would like to form a communal colony. And so when they managed to get the property and get it going, naturally it's Drop City. One of the most misunderstood names in the whole communal world, I think. Lots of people think it meant dropping out or dropping acid.
Uh-huh.
And it was neither. It was drop art, art that was dropped out of a second-story window.
This is a very archetypal American narrative in a lot of ways, this utopian vision, whether it's religious community or a community just based on secular idealism, but they had this big sort of wide open door policy. Anyone was welcome. A guy named Peter Rabbit joined the commune and really started publicizing it. Mm-hmm. And they eventually wound up in Time magazine. And what happened from there? More people came, I presume, mm-hmm. than they could accommodate.
Yes. It was never actually officially an open land commune. It's more that there just weren't rules. Anyone could come because there was no one in charge and no one to turn them away. But that led to problems. I think inevitably, if you're going to have a non-restrictive policy, it just seems to be inescapable that you're going to have some problems. You're going to attract some people that really are not going to be contributing in a positive way to the whole project. That's what happened. They got some what would you say? Well, mental cases, I suppose, would be accurate. People that had real problems and became more trouble than they were worth. And I think the Bernofskys got pretty tired of the whole thing. This wasn't their vision. They had thought it would be a tighter little community of artists doing these creative things. I mean, they, I think in their first year or two, think that they really did some wonderful things. But They saw it going in a bad direction, and they just decided to bail and took off. Clark Rickard did not agree with that assessment. He thought it had a lot going for it, and he stayed on for, I don't know, a couple more years at least. The influence was very considerable. An awful lot of people visited and took pictures. They were featured in a number of national publications, and I think inspired a lot of people. There were domes built on other communes, many of them in different parts of the country. I think people were really excited. I mean, that was a radical new idea. They didn't exist until then. So I just think its cultural influence is important to note. Even though it didn't last very long, it really was a breakthrough culturally. And I admire the spirit that was behind it, that whole matter of we're not going to conform. We're not going to do what society expects us. We're going to go out here, and, well, the phrase they used over and over, we're going to create a whole new civilization. And maybe they didn't quite do that, but I sure think they inspired a lot of people.
That was KRCC's Noel Black speaking with Timothy Miller, professor of religious studies at University of Kansas and author of The 60s Communes, Hippies and Beyond. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Miller will be speaking at the Pueblo Rawlings Library on May 23rd as part of the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Drop City. Two exhibits will be opening Friday, March 6th, at the Rawlings Library Info Zone News Museum in Pueblo. The first features the winners of a poster contest celebrating the 50th anniversary of Drop City. The second is a collection of photographs taken of the commune by the great photographer Myron Wood. For a complete listing of Drop City-related events this spring, and for an audio slideshow on the history and architecture of the commune, head to krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. I'm Jake Brownell, and this is The Big Something, a new show from KRCC featuring in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. Up next, we hear from Sylvia Nasser. Nasser has spent years as a journalist covering economics for such publications as Fortune Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, The New York Times, and The New Yorker. In 1998, she published her first book, A Beautiful Mind, a biography of the brilliant Nobel Prize-winning economist and mathematician John Nash, who also suffered from schizophrenia. The book won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and was adapted into an Academy Award-winning film starring Russell Crowe. Her second book, Grand Pursuit, The Story of Economic Genius, is a sweeping account of the evolution of modern economic thought, and was released to great acclaim in 2011. I spoke with Sylvia Nasser while she was in Colorado Springs recently to give a lecture at Colorado College. So I'd like to begin by talking a bit about your book, Grand Pursuit, The Story of Economic Genius. In the first line of the book, you say, quote, "The idea that humanity could turn the tables on economic necessity, mastering rather than being enslaved by material circumstances, is so new that Jane Austen never entertained it." Can you describe what exactly that meant for people who lived in Jane Austen's time or before that?
Okay, so around 1800, the average Englishman who was a farm laborer lived no better than a Roman slave. His food intake was about the same as a hunter, member of a hunter-gatherer tribe. He lived in a single room. His clothes were the ones on his back. His transportation was, you know, his own feet. If he wasn't hungry, he lived in fear of starvation. And he knew that his children's life was going to be exactly like his. Everyone knew their place, and they knew that they were stuck in their place. So the idea was not that you were going to change things, that it was possible to change things, but rather that you had to find a way of making peace with it. In other words, resigning yourself to a rather grim reality. And that describes 9 out of 10 people living in England at the peak of the Enlightenment.
And so your book kind of tells the story of how humanity, how our society kind of gradually learned to master its material circumstances.
Right. It's about the invention of modern economics as an instrument not of resignation, but of improving the lives and prospects of ordinary people.
And when was it that the idea that we could, in fact, move in society, that society could be better, when was it that idea first really surfaced?
The Industrial Revolution was about 100 years old by the 1860s, yet the prevailing orthodoxy was shared by the left and the right, from Karl Marx to John Stuart Mill to Thomas Carlyle. Everyone, quotes, knew, unquote, that wages, which of course determine the living standard of most of the people alive in England, could never rise far from, or permanently, from mere subsistence. So the idea was that all these technological marvels, the expansion of trade and wealth of the nation wasn't going to change the circumstances of 9 out of 10 people in England. In the 1860s is when the first inventor of modern economics, Alfred Marshall, sees that real wages, that is the purchasing power of wage, are actually been going up since the mid-40s, something that economic theory and received economic wisdom says is impossible. And trying to solve that paradox leads him to an understanding of what he calls the ingenious mechanism.
And what is that ingenious mechanism?
Okay. Unlike Karl Marx, who was living in London at the same time and never stepped into a factory, and of course, almost never had a paying job, Alfred Marshall, who was a don at Cambridge, spent every summer, every holiday, visiting the industrial centers of England, interviewing everyone from the owner to the worker to the managers, and learning how wages were set, learning how everything from cotton cloth to steel to machinery was made, really learning to understand business. So what he discovered is really two things. One is that competition, which was very fierce in all these industries, seemed to be driving managers and owners to constantly look for ways to make a little more with given resources. And they did it by streamlining production or tweaking the product design or in 100 different ways. But it was a constant focus of management. The other thing that he noticed was that these firms were, in fact, paying skilled workers multiples of what they paid unskilled workers, which suggested that wages were determined by the workers' contribution to current production, i.e. that they were related to productivity. Okay, so this is a long way of saying that what he discovered was that wages would rise, did rise with productivity. That suggested that this whole class of people, the proletariat who simply existed to work for other people, that their conditions would improve, that the proletariat eventually, through this process that was intrinsic to the market economy, would actually lift these people out of poverty.
And so his insight was essentially that this static society that had existed for centuries,
right,
millennia, wasn't so static anymore.
Was no longer that static, right. And discovered that the business firm, the corporation, which was normally thought of simply as an institution for enriching the owners, was that its economic function was actually to raise the average standard of living in society.
A lot of, I think, what your book does really well is kind of tell the story of how these great thinkers, these great economists, came to understand the things that they came to understand, and how, in a way, these great theories that we have inherited as a society from these economists really did grow out of observation and out of very specific historical circumstances. Was that part of the goal for you in writing this book, was to sort of tell the story of how those things came to life?
Absolutely, because I just think that, you know, most people who are not enamored of economics are very turned off by it because it seems to be, you know, very dry, very abstract. And getting in touch with the things that inspired and perplexed and drew people in, and to see the world through their eyes, is a way to understand the most basic ideas which are relevant to people who are not economists.
Is there a particular character from this book who maybe typifies that phenomenon in some ways, or whose story is particularly compelling that maybe for someone who hasn't read the book, they could kind of get a sense of that?
I have several favorite characters, but one of them is certainly Beatrice Webb, Beatrice Potter, who is this wealthy heiress, wealthy, beautiful, who's destined to marry a rich and important man, who in fact wants to marry a rich and important man, but she also wants to do something else, which is to be a social investigator, to understand what's going on in Victorian society. And she starts out as a libertarian, an enemy of big government and government regulation, which, of course, was much tinier then than it is now. And by the time she's 30, as a result of both the change in public mood, which was much more activist, and also the personal experiences, she went underground for a while in a sweatshop to write about it. She had journalistic aspirations. She took part in her cousin Charles Booth's survey of the poor in London. So she has this unlikely career in which she eventually invents the idea of the modern welfare state. The received wisdom was that if you taxed the most productive members of society to lift up the bottom and truly destitute third of English society, you would destroy the ingenious mechanism, you would destroy incentives. What she argued, and she was a brilliant packager of radical ideas as natural and evolutionary and really practical. She argued that, look, this bottom third of destitute Londoners, they're so deprived that they can't serve in the army, they can't work, they can't raise their children. And if the government guarantees every English citizen a minimum standard of life, then these people are not going to lower productivity growth, they're going to become contributing members of society. So she made a conservative supply-side argument for government intervention, which now, of course, we to every government makes that commitment.
That sort of brings us to the present in a way where I think that for a lot of people who pay attention to economic debates and to political debates around economics, it tends, at least today, to seem to revolve around the role of government in the economy. How much should the government be able to tax? Is the government's intervention a positive thing or a negative thing? Has that kind of always been a strain of argument in the economic history?
Yes, and I think one that is so distorted because if you look at, let's say you look at the two countries in the world that have the best or almost the best long-term productivity performance, who would you guess they are? And stock market performance.
The United States.
Yes. And who's the other one?
Maybe England.
Sweden. Okay. So look, Sweden's government is twice as big relative to the economy as the United States government. Okay. And yet, Sweden's private sector produces this very rapid productivity growth, and obviously the average Swede is very affluent. What does that tell you? It tells you that, that first of all, it's not the size of government that necessarily wags the dog. It's if you have a very competitive private sector, which Sweden does, and you know your politics and your culture, etc., are such that you want a big welfare state and you don't mind high taxes, you can have it. You know, once you start looking at the data, you see that these either-or propositions, which so much of our economic debate is cast in, are nonsense because it depends, okay? And in this particular case, it depends, again, on productivity growth. If you've got that, you can have a small welfare state like we do, a big welfare state like Sweden, and, you know, changes at the margin, which is all that we ever talk about. You know, even though the rhetoric may be, oh, we're going to, the welfare state is going to be dead or it's going to take over everything, but we're always talking about changes at the margin. The consequences couldn't possibly be, you know, whichever way you go, as catastrophic as, you know, the people in the debate say.
Right. And in some ways, would you say that it boils down to the fact that from a theory perspective and from the perspective of economists, there's maybe more consensus about what works and what doesn't work than the political debate
yes.
would let you believe?
I think, yes, exactly. And that's one of the, you know, I tried in the course of this book to write about Keynes and Hayek, not from a you know, partisan point of view, but to show how each of them contributed to our general understanding.
There has been sort of a renewed focus on economic issues in, I guess, sort of since the recession and since
right.
the rise of things like Occupy Wall Street and this discussion about inequality. I wonder, you know, what your research into the history of economics leads you to think about the contemporary debate, especially around the issue of inequality and sort of where it fits within the broader tradition of economic debate and thought.
Well, I was actually just thinking about that. I, you know, since I teach economic journalism, I look at a lot of this data, and a couple of things have struck me. One is that it's absolutely true that inequality of income and of wealth has grown. It's been growing since the early 70s. It's not a new phenomenon. Yet, at the same time, and this is a question of perspective, over that period, the bottom 80% absolute incomes have actually grown. Okay? So it's absolutely true that the gap is widening. It's not true that as the rich get richer, the poor have gotten poorer. That and the fact that this trend is not unique to the United States, it's not even unique to rich countries, it's almost a global phenomenon. In other words, in almost every country, the share of income going to labor has declined. That alone suggests that this is not necessarily an issue of, well, certainly not an issue of U.S. tax policy, okay? It's probably not an issue of capital versus labor. It probably has more to do with technology and possibly in a sort of secondary way, globalization. Once you start looking at the details, then the easy explanations, and particularly the partisan explanations, kind of very quickly fall by the wayside. And I think that's a really good thing, because there are lots of things that we could consider doing. I mean, I happen to think that it's the bottom 20% that we should really be worrying about, not so much the top 1%. Somebody else may disagree. There are lots of things that we could be doing, but I think that doing what Marshall did, which is taking the data seriously instead of making sweeping statements, is a really good thing.
I just have one last question for you, which is, you wrote the book A Beautiful Mind, which is about John Nash, and who was a genius and a very tortured figure. And then this book, the subtitle is A Story of Economic Genius. I wonder, what is it that attracts you to brilliance in a way, and to brilliant figures like that?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a little bit mysterious, you know, so you actually really wonder how did they come up with that, because it's not obvious. People are generally really entertaining. Beatrice Webb was the greatest diarist of her age. She sometimes had pretty bad judgment about economics, but she was a great judge and a great caricaturist of people. John Maynard Keynes was a universal man. He could do everything. He could, you know, he made vast amounts of money investing. He was a tremendous patriot who saved Britain from bankruptcy. He was a passionate art collector.
So with genius comes some amount of eccentricity and
right.
Intrigue there.
And creativity and personality, yes, yes. And, of course, other interesting friends.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you.
I'm Jake Brownell, and that was my conversation with Sylvia Nasser, professor of business journalism at Columbia University and Pulitzer Prize-nominated author of the books A Beautiful Mind and, more recently, Grand Pursuit, The Story of Economic Genius. Nasser was in Colorado Springs to speak at Colorado College as part of the H. Chase Stone Lecture Series. For links to her work, head to krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Something, a new show from KRCC featuring in-depth conversations on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. Artist Senga Nangudi has lived, taught, and worked in the Colorado Springs region for the past 2 decades, all the while making and exhibiting her work on the international stage. Her work, which often uses pantyhose to create abstracted sculptural forms, is designed to be, quote, activated by interactions with dancers who stretch and move within the pieces. Though difficult to categorize, her work evokes women's bodies both present and absent. Producer Noel Black sat down and spoke with Nangudi last summer on the occasion of her dual retrospective at the Museum of Contemporary Art and Red Line Gallery in Denver.
To start off with kind of broad background, would you talk about your childhood, where you grew up, just a little bit, and how you became an artist?
And how the world began.
Yes. Also, if you would go through Genesis.
Right. Exactly. Wow. Okay. Very quickly. I was born in Chicago, and we moved to California when I was about 5 years old. We moved to Los Angeles, and we moved to Pasadena. So we kind of bounced between Pasadena and Los Angeles, and basically Southern California. And my dad died when I was 3. So I was raised by a single mom who did a wonderful job, I must say. So most of my education, my rearing, my cultural set was in Los Angeles. And I lived in New York for a number of years. And I lived in Japan for a year, grad studies in Tokyo, Waseda University, which was a major influence on me. And in the end of 1989, we moved to Colorado Springs. And everyone says, well, why did you move to Colorado Springs? You know, was it a job or so on and so forth? Well, my husband and I had two children. And they were at that age, just heading into high school, just heading into junior high. And there was something on the ballot called Proposition 13 in Los Angeles, which changed the landscape of Los Angeles forever. And that,
what was that?
It was cutting out a lot of public services for youth, for general services for the community. And everyone said, oh, you know, it's fine. It's a year out and nothing's happened and so on. But everything crashed after that. That's when the gangs really took hold. That's when a lot of really difficult things started happening in California, in Los Angeles. And we decided that it was time to move. So we wandered around Arizona, New Mexico, and so on and so forth. And all four of us agreed on Colorado Springs. People were friendly and so on. It was a cultural shock for us all, coming from, you know, an urban environment to sweet Colorado Springs, which is very small at the time. And so we've been here shockingly ever since.
Talk about your art career just a little bit. Like, when did you know that you wanted to be an artist, that you were an artist?
Well, I never know, you know, I'm still asking myself that question, but my desire to be an artist started, you know, quite young and kind of bounced between dance and art. And finally in college, when I had to decide a major, I said, I guess I'll do art as a major, because if you're a dancer, you only have a limited span for your career and you can be 100 and be an artist.
Although I have to say, I've seen some really amazing older people dancing, doing amazing things.
It's true. It's true, because the whole dance community and the way dance is looked at is quite different. But when I started, you had to have a ponytail and you had to be very slender and all that kind of stuff. And that was never, you know, what I look like. But now I've seen women 300 pounds just do amazing stuff. In general, it's open to everyone now. But that wasn't the case then. So I had to decide.
One of your recent retrospectives in New York at the Urban Gallery was of your performance works. Mm-hmm. It was 1976 to 1981. Mm-hmm. And RSVP as part of that, really one of your iconic pieces. And that is a dance piece and an art piece together. And it's incredible. And it's incredible both as a static piece and as a dance piece. For those who haven't seen it, what I would describe is pantyhose attached to a blank wall. Mm-hmm. And in one performance that I saw, the dancer stood in front of it and was attached to it in a way that made the dancer and the piece look like a spider. Mm-hmm. And then when the dance began, the piece increasingly came to look like a web, but also other things much more abstract. And so there was this kind of movement between, you know, freedom and bondage, and really just lovely that it's not just the dancer that's moving, it's the piece that's moving with the dancer and changing, which is just, you know, absolutely gorgeous. So,
well, it's a great description. And one of the reasons I decided also to use pantyhose outside of their ability to stretch is that when a woman wears a pantyhose, we are usually in stressful situations. We're at a party, we're going on a job interview. Just the formal use of pantyhose indicates that it is somewhat stressful. And so I really like the idea. And in the beginning, I would use pantyhose of friends, you know, okay. And I would wash them, of course. And pretty soon I needed more than friends could offer. So I would get them at stores, you know, thrift stores and so on and so forth. And I really felt as though the because they were used, they were infused by the energy of the person that used them. Mm-hmm. All those things that they went through when they wore these pantyhose would be infused in it. I still get my dance in there some kind of way. And I can do it on my own terms. And with Répondez s'il vous plaît, it was a matter of finding a material that kind of reflected the body. And when I had my children, I was just amazed and dumbfounded at the ability of the body to be elastic and to go back into shape after, you know, extending. And so I really, and not only that, but you kind of go, well, I went through kind of like really psychological things. You know, your psyche kind of stretches too. There's a lot of new different things, you know, the chemistry in your body, the hormones and all of that. So I wanted a material that could express, you know, the stretching of the psyche, the stretching of the body, and then the human ability to come back to itself. I decided that I wanted to do more than just have a piece. I wanted to interact with it, and I wanted other people to interact with it. And that's where RSVP comes from. You know, I want you to respond. I don't want you to just be an observer looking at a piece of art. I want you to be with me. And so oftentimes with an exhibit during those times, I would set up a performance and I would interact with the piece, or some of my friends would interact with the piece. And then what was left, I considered an artifact. And so that's how it is.
You found the work that you would continue to do in many different forms with many different mediums really early on in your career. And you've continued to do that. What is that like as an artist to kind of find that way of working, a medium that you've created essentially, because it really is a new medium.
So I've always been interested in movement. And with the pantyhose, it was sort of like, I was searching, and I was so excited when I finally came upon this idea. And even with that, I thought, oh gosh, you know, how can I preserve this? You know, and I tried resin, dipping it in resin, dipping it in glue and all that sort of thing. And it just didn't do it for me. I just had to have this kind of sense of naturalness. And curiously enough, they have lasted, the natural ones, but the experiments I did with resin and so on, it just totally destroyed the pantyhose after a while, you know, the elements of the pantyhose. And it's sort of like a combination lock. You know, you do the combination and then all of a sudden you hear that wonderful click and it opens. And that's how it felt with that. And plus I had to go deep with it. I mean, they're fairly emotional pieces. They're a combination of humor and maybe the word would be pathos, because there's some very intense issues that I'm dealing with in terms of body image. And I thought when I started out that these would be issues that would be resolved in the future. However, as these kind of retrospectives are happening, I'm finding that it's even worse now than it was then in terms of people not being happy with themselves and reconstructive surgery, you know, not for health reasons, but, you know, a new nose, a new this, a new that. So these, and it's becoming younger as opposed to before. So these issues are right in our face right now.
Have you felt that the art world itself has become
more responsive to women and women's work? Or do you feel that there's still the same or more sexism? Or have you felt things kind of open up?
They're open in a sense. When I was in school, I was one of only two women in the sculpture department. Also, most of the curators were men, period. Most of the artists were men, period. But now there's kind of a flip over. Most of the curators I run into are women. And similarly with artists, there are many, you know, more female artists now than there were before. So in that case, it's more of an open field. But some of the issues, you know, remain, of course. But just availability is quite different.
What about issues about being an African-American artist?
It's sort of, I guess the whole game is there's still a feeling like, you know, it's like bean counting or something. We need you to look good. And there's still an issue sometimes of we're inviting you to our party as opposed to this is an equal playing field. Anytime you welcome somebody to a party, you're in control. And so there's still that kind of feeling, not totally being respected. However, I must say to you, now it's a burgeoning field. Now there are these amazing, wonderful artists that are coming out of Yale that have outstanding careers. And they're able to do stuff that it took my generation a lifetime to do. Those young whippersnappers. So, you know, it's difficult, but there's so many blessings that they are able to experience now.
Have you gotten acknowledgement from younger artists who said
yes.
you blazed a trail
yes.
for me?
And it's so gratifying.
I bet.
I mean, it is. I'm kind of shocked every time it happens. But yes, they are just highly respectful of the work that we put in before that.
So I want to ask you about one more minority issue, which mm-hmm. is being a mother and being a working artist. Mm-hmm. How have you dealt with those challenges?
Mm-hmm. Again, in the beginning of time, it was stated at that point, just generally in the air, you cannot be an artist and a mother. You will have to decide. I had that challenge. I had that huge challenge. And I think more and more women are doing that now. But again, back then, that was not the case. You know, you had to make a decision about it. And it wasn't easy, but my husband, you know, has always been quite supportive. And then, you know, I give props to my friends, several of my friends who were single moms, and they kept it going too.
Babysitting, sharing, co-ops,
yes.
things like that?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. All of that just to make it work. We were able to call on each other. And again, if it was about babysitting and so on, you know, we were there for each other. And, you know, the kids were the better for it, I think.
What about your choice of materials? Your work has a strong conceptual component to it. Was that really deliberate to say, if I used found materials, recycled materials, I'll have more time to do the intellectual work? Was that a conscious choice for you?
It was conscious on a couple of levels. There was a conscious decision in the Black arts community to have this Phoenix Rising kind of situation. And instead of using traditional materials, we decided to use materials that we could find. And plus, it was a matter of economics. We didn't have that much money, so that came into play. It was just a very stimulating time. It was a time of exploration and the ability to do things in another way. For instance, if you were doing performance art or happenings, if you wanted to be a dancer yet you couldn't fit into the, you know, the professional realm, you could utilize it conceptually or play a guitar or stand on your head or whatever.
talk about the pseudonyms that you created for yourself mm-hmm. to work under. You have a really great statement about it on your website, but I'll let you say it in your words.
Okay. So I don't remember what those words were, but I'll tell you the experience. I went into a bookstore. Actually, it was Hooked on Books. And they had, a rack of cards. And I saw this really fantastic card. It was kind of African-like, you know. And I went, wow, this is beautiful. And I flipped it over, and a white artist had done it. And I went, what? Are you kidding me? And then I checked myself, and I said, wow, she has a right to do that. Why is that? And so then I started thinking about the issue when someone goes into an exhibit and they see a name, an ethnic name, that automatically they decide that that piece should look a certain way.
And this has been documented, especially in workplaces, that people, their names are often mm-hmm. will indicate, if they indicate race, that they get discriminated against.
Absolutely. So it's quite interesting, and in a sense, as an artist, it's quite limiting. Even within the culture itself, that they will say, well, you can't do that because that's not reflective of our cultural background. I started playing with that. And so I have Harriet Chen, which is the persona I use for my paintings and drawings. Lily B. Moore, which is for my writings. And Propecia Lee, which is for my photography. So it allows me to explore and to really kind of get a sense, if I can, if I'm in that same place, how people respond to the work.
Just one final question for you. Mm-hmm. You've had work acquired by lots of, what are considered top tier institutions,
it's
including
wonderful.
The Brooklyn Museum yeah. and MoMA. Yeah, I just wanted right. to ask you, what does that mean to you as an artist? And are there places that you would like to still get into?
I'm thrilled. I feel blessed. I feel dumbfounded. I feel, it's just amazing. It's just really, I can't speak enough about it. And to know that with institutions like that, the work is being seen, by hundreds and hundreds of people, sometimes in a day. And and I hear the feedback is quite good. So it's amazing, but it still boils down to the work and what have you done lately. That's just one series, and I've done a lot, since then, but that seems to strike a chord with people, that particular series.
The RSVP.
Yeah, the RSVP series. I guess it's like human to human, so to speak. So it's exceptional. I would just, I'm happy whoever, if it's a private collector, if it's, anyone that seems taken with my work, I'm just thrilled about it. I would love to go back to Japan and, maybe have something there. I'm open. I'm open.
Sanga Nanguti, thank you so much for coming in and congratulations on your
new
shows.
Thank you so much.
That was producer Noel Black speaking with artist Sanga Nanguti. You can see some of Nanguti's work on display at the Idea Space in the Edith Kinney Gaylord Cornerstone Arts Center on the Colorado College campus through March 7th. Go to krcc.org for complete information and to see a slideshow of images of Nanguti's work. The Big Something is produced by Noel Black and me, Jake Brownell, for KRCC, with help from Emily Frogen and Amelia Whitmer. You can listen again to this episode and learn more about today's guests at krcc.org. The Big Something is part of KRCC Presents, a new weekly showcase of locally produced content right here on Radio Colorado College. Tune in for original, local programming every Friday at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. on 91.5 Radio Colorado College.